You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, good morning. My name is Clark Lemming. With the court's permission, I would like to say 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
This case contains a number of issues, three different counts, any which of the complaint contained, any which of is dispositive of the case. But the factual background is extremely important. In 1970, the Spotsylvania County Planning Commission, before the county had a zoning ordinance, approved a master plan for the Bragg Hill development. It consisted of 11 sections, 168 total units. The Planning Commission approved a revised master plan 2 years later. In 1973, the county adopted an ordinance, and this was placed in the county's R2 zoning district, which exactly coincided with what had been approved by the Planning Commission. Evidence in the file is that this was customary business for the Planning Commission when there were multiple section developments. The project moved forward, and six sections were built out. Meanwhile, in 1984, after annexation hearings, the city of Fredericksburg annexed the property that included the Bragg Hill development. At the time of the annexation, on the date of annexation, the property was automatically somehow relegated to the city's R1 zoning district, the most restrictive of all of the zoning districts, making it impossible to proceed with the project. The county did so in ostensibly under the authority of an ordinance that it adopted in 1972, which simply says that any annexed property coming into the city would be in the R1 zoning district, shall be in the R1 zoning district.
But why doesn't the 1991 and the 2014 actions of the city make all of this...
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. Well, first, in response to that, is that if the city's action, however it occurred in 1984, is void ab initio. Void ab initio, it's void from the beginning. Nothing can be done to enhance that. There are not degrees of voidness. Something that was void at the beginning doesn't become unvoid later.
Yeah, but now, if the argument is due process and lack of procedural due process, which is notice, and it's void for that reason, it can be held void, and it's, and due process is later given, twice,
yes, sir,
given, and exactly the same alleged deprivation occurs, then there's no due process question later. There may be some other question, but not fair notice, right?
Yes, sir, I understand your question, and let me go through the particular things that happened. In 1987, there was a text amendment to the R1 zoning district. Now, there's not particular evidence of that, at least in the form of an actual ordinance. And in 2014, in the staff report, the county concedes that the property was limited to 2 units per acre throughout. So we're not sure what to make of that. But the most important thing is that it's a text amendment. It doesn't affect any of the underlying zoning. If it was or was not zoned R1 in 1984, what happened in 1987 changed none of that.
I'm looking at 1991 and 2014.
Yes, in 1991, what we have is an effort to rezone the property. And we can see there was an application to try to rezone the entire property. However, what the city of Fredericksburg did was to zone a different property altogether, 17 acres, not part of the property that is before the court. And whatever happened, what the city's ordinance says is that that was rezoned. That's all that it says. It doesn't say what was done with the remainder of the property. Is the application still sitting out there somehow? I don't know what the answer to that is, but the point is that the city, the locality, speak through their ordinances.
Council, is
yes, sir.
I mean, Bragg Hill, this is the 1991 rezoning?
Yes, sir.
Bragg Hill indicated it had no problem with doing a partial rezoning.
Bragg Hill indicated that it would accept the rezoning of the 17 acres, Your Honor. But I still think...
I think
what
no
that's,
problem actually is the exact quote.
I think that what the court is doing by getting into that analysis is looking beyond the face of the order itself. I mean, the ordinance itself very clearly says what happened. I don't think there's authority to go behind that ordinance and say, well, here's why it didn't happen. It's not unambiguous.
Well, what this member of the court is actually heading towards is having some passing knowledge of how these things work. It appears that there was if not a negotiation, at least a robust discussion between Bragg Hill and the city back in 1991 to come to an agreeable and agreed resolution. Is that true?
There were discussions. There were some public discussions, some things said in public. What happened behind the scenes is an evidentiary question. I don't know of any specific agreement to go this way rather than that. We know what was said on the record, and we know what the city council ultimately did.
Well, we know that there was a, shall we say, a robust rezoning application.
Yes, sir.
And then there was a different resolution, and Bragg Hill said, we got no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
All that is on the record, is it
yes,
not?
Sir. Yes, sir. Yes, that is on the record.
Okay.
The issue still is whether or not that moves the analysis past what the ordinance says. Okay. The ordinance simply says it was these 17 acres were rezoned, does nothing with the remaining portion of the tract.
Okay.
Now, back to Your Honor's question, in 2014, bear in mind, and this all goes back to the issue, I think, of whether the 1984 action was void in the first place, and what do you do about that if the property was never zoned R1?
Why it's void? If it's void because of due process, fair notice, then that can be cured.
Is that the underlying problem, initially, was a failure of procedural due process notice?
It's broader than that, I think, okay. Your Honor. That was one of the three things that we allege, and not necessarily in that order. But none of the procedural indicia were observed.
And what I was wondering is, you know, typically you have, so you're in Spotsylvania or in Fredericksburg, and the locality wants to rezone. And they can't do that in the dead of night and affect people's rights without notice and opportunity. But when you have an annexation, it's a very public hearing. There's all kinds of notices and newspapers talking about it. And then, of course, of necessity, when you go from one jurisdiction into another, you're going to have new classifications and a different scheme. So I was trying to figure out why the annexation, the very process of annexation, doesn't provide some measure of notice of what's happening.
Well, I don't mean to get into evidence. I mean, that's one of the problems here. We don't have an evidentiary base in testimony. I mean, there were hearings about the annexation. There was no hearings involving the zoning or what would happen. That all happened automatically. But back to your question, the indicia, the failure to observe the procedural indicia, none of it was done. If you look at Town of Vinton, which I think is the most important case that we have out there, it's not an annexation case, but the town did adopt an emergency ordinance, and it didn't observe any of the procedural indicia, including the due process part of it. And then later adopted another ordinance, and what the court does is to strike the whole thing. Void emergency ordinance, the other ordinance goes out, the property goes back to an unzoned status, and the court notes that it was, you know, the absence of due process. Nothing was contained in the statute authorizing the emergency powers to skip that. And same thing here. There's nothing in the statute. And the court says in that case, we think it was by design that ability to bypass those procedural safeguards was there. But beyond just that, Your Honor, what we have is an ordinance that doesn't track the enabling statute to do this sort of thing. They're apples and oranges. There's nothing in the local ordinance about anything being temporary, and of course it lasted for 30 years, so it's anything but temporary. So that's a completely separate ground, I think, for the 1984 action being void ab initio. They exceeded the scope of their authority. And
you mentioned in your earlier answer that there were three reasons why the original action was void ab initio. One was procedural due process.
Yes.
What were the other two?
There were two aspects to the statute, the enabling statute. One is simply that they don't track the statute. The statute on its face.
It's a statutory procedural violation. What's the third?
The third is what I was just indicating, that the application of the statute was anything but temporary.
Okay, got all of that. Why isn't all of that curable? Because none of that is void ab initio in the sense that it can't be cured.
I don't
just do a do-over and do it all right the next time.
And indeed, Your Honor, if the city had started with a new piece of property, if they had started from scratch, that could be done. But that's not what happened here. What happened?
Did 14 have the effect of doing that? They did a massive.
No, sir. I don't believe so, because what happened in 2014, 30 years after the fact, is that the city, recognizing something is wrong, says the ordinance again. The city speaks through its ordinance. The ordinance says it's going to rezone on the face of the ordinance the R1 properties. If it wasn't zoned R1, that 1914 rezoning did nothing. Now beyond that, putting form over substance, the only thing that happened in 2014 is that the number was changed. The districts are otherwise exactly identical, and the city eliminated the R1 district as being redundant because they just moved it over to R2. So,
but they followed all the statutory requirements.
They did, yes, sir. Yes,
process.
Sir.
They had the hearing on the day that said they're going to have a hearing, and all the dots were dotted, all the I's were dotted, the T's crossed.
Yes, sir.
Why didn't they cure the problem?
Well, because the only way it could have been cured is if it were legitimately zoned R1 in the first place. And it's void ab initio.
But isn't there a difference between a void ab initio court order and the exercise of sovereign power? I mean, suppose you have a statute that the General Assembly is invalid for whatever reason under, you know, maybe it violates a single object rule under the state constitution or whatever. So they messed it up, and that statute's void. Well, they reconvene, pass a new statute, exercising their sovereign power with all the, you know, boxes being checked. Isn't that, I mean, so it seems like we're defaulting back to this court model of a void ab initio.
Well, but number one, Your Honor, I do think that it's different because this is a locality, and we have the Dillon rule in the state, and the courts have traditionally held the localities very strictly to those rules. You don't have the authority, and the remedies that have been issued and mandated and ordered by this court wipe the whole thing out completely. You know, it's not something that I think, as has been suggested, that you can simply, 30 years after the fact, go back and fix if it wasn't good in the first place.
30 days after the fact. Suppose every single problem with the 1984 administrative rezoning thing had been done exactly right, according to Hoyle. Could they have done it 3 days after the fact and said, look, we don't think you're right on all this, but we're going to do it exactly the way you think we're supposed to do it?
I'm not sure what the answer is to that, but as a practical matter, if something had gotten taken care of quickly, I don't think we would be here, but it didn't.
Well, if you don't know the answer to that, I don't know how your argument can prevail, because if they can do it 3 days after the fact and cure it, they can do it 3,000 years after the fact and cure it.
The simple answer, Your Honor, and I think the logical answer, is simply that if it's void, it's void. It's not something that you can go back and say, okay, we're taking this R1 district and now doing something else with it. It never became an R1 district in the first place.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
Yes, sir. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I am Kathleen Dooley. I'm the Fredericksburg City Attorney. With me at council table is George Somerville of Harmon, Claytor & Corrigan. We ask the Court to affirm the judgment of the trial court, and I believe that the best and narrowest grounds available for that judgment is that there is no justiciable controversy in this case. Count 1 is moot. Count 2, for Count 2, the vested rights claim, Bragg Hill elected its remedy and prosecuted that remedy to a final decision. And Count 3, Bragg Hill has a Rule 5:17 problem, but it also, Count 3, simply does not meet the elements of a procedural due process claim. With respect to Count 1, we know that for an actual controversy to exist, it must exist on present facts. The existence of an actual controversy is at least in part a question of fact. Bragg Hill's complaint, the allegations of fact in the complaint, actually stop in 1984, and the city had to produce the rest of the story through its plea and bar. The present facts governing the property today are the 2014 rezoning ordinance adopted by City Council, and as Bragg Hill just conceded, that ordinance was adopted through the full statutory process. We know from the Town of Vinton case and Potomac Greens that when the governing body follows the statutory process, it acquires jurisdiction to make the wholly legislative decision of zoning or rezoning. We know from Laird versus City of Danville that zoning and rezoning is a wholly legislative decision. City Council made that decision in 2014, and that's the law that governs the use and development of the property today. Count one is moot. We did add the 1991 application from Bragg Hill, where they made the exact case to the governing body in 1991 that they claim in their complaint that they never had an opportunity to present. That's the exact case that they presented to the governing body. The governing body considered that case in 1991. And remember that under the statute, Bragg Hill had an opportunity, had the right under the statute, to file an appeal in circuit court contesting the decision of the governing body to adopt or failing to adopt a zoning or rezoning amendment. So 1991, we added for good measure, but the count one is moot. With respect to count two, the vested rights claim, we know that under the Holland decision in 1991, an adjudication of vested rights was purely judicial. Only the judiciary had the right to make those decisions. The General Assembly amended the statute in 1998 to add authority for zoning administrators to make vested rights decisions. And in the Crucible case in 2009, the court said that the two remedies are concurrent, that there was no requirement to go for a zoning administrator's determination first, that the landowner may elect between the two. Bragg Hill made the election in 2009 to seek a zoning administrator's determination of its vested rights claim, and that election became binding upon Bragg Hill when the zoning administrator actually issued that determination. I think any time until the zoning administrator issued his determination, Bragg Hill could have withdrawn that request and said, we're going to go to court instead. But they didn't. And we know that under the Lilly case, when a zoning administrator makes a determination, that determination is final and binding on the parties unless it's timely appealed to the BZA. Now, Bragg Hill did appeal the zoning administrator's determination to the BZA, but the BZA upheld it. And as the circuit court, the trial judge, pointed out, it would be absurd to say that a zoning administrator's decision, if not appealed, is final. But if it is appealed and upheld, somehow it's no longer final and is subject to collateral attack years later through a declaratory judgment action. With respect to count three, I do believe that Bragg Hill has a Rule 5:17 problem because their assignment of error number two did not list count three in the court's ruling that count three was moot. But obviously we don't rely only on the Rule 5:17. When you think about a procedural due process claim, element number one is that the landowner asserts, I have a property interest, I have a property right. The right that Bragg Hill asserts it possessed was the vested right. And as you saw, that decision has been made adverse to Bragg Hill. And in fact, the decision was made on the basis of the absence of a significant affirmative governmental act in the first place. There simply was no act, and that decision is final. Second element of a procedural due process claim is that the landowner has been deprived of that property right by an action of the government. And we know that if there was a vested right, the thing that it does is survive a subsequent zoning amendment of the property. That's what vested rights are for. Bragg Hill alleges that the city deprived it of its vested right by rezoning the property, and that's just an impossibility. Finally, with respect to a justiciable controversy and procedural fencing, I believe that Bragg Hill would have had a perfect remedy at law if there was any sense to count three whatsoever, that it would have had a perfect remedy at law through an inverse condemnation claim and a seeking of just compensation. And in that case, the city would have had defenses such as the economically viable use of the land that was remaining and our valid exercise of the police power. So for the foregoing reasons, I believe that the trial court's judgment was correct. The case does not present a justiciable controversy between the parties. The court makes that ruling in its sound discretion, without a sound discretion, and that's the standard of review here. And in fact, courts are admonished that they have an affirmative duty not to decide a case which is moot, where the opinion would be advisory only. And for the foregoing reasons, I respectfully request that the case, that the court affirm the judgment of the trial court and dismiss the complaint.
Rebuttal.
May it please the court again. With regard to count two, this court's case in Chilton, Maloney versus Engel, 2017 case, is instructive. It compares the BZA acting in its variance capacity to a court of competent jurisdiction and basically says the BZA is not equivalent to a court. They're not the safeguards, the procedures in place at that level. Now, this was a vesting determination. Vesting is a common law property right in Virginia. And what the trial court did through its ruling is basically to elevate the status of the BZA to a comparable court. There's been no circuit court hearing on this issue ever. I think that the same reasoning in the Chilton...
Isn't that because you didn't ask for one?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that because you did not ask for one?
Well, then we get into, and allusion was made to the appeal, the two statutes that cover appeals from the zoning administrator to the BZA, and then the BZA to the circuit court are completely different. That mandatory language appears at that first level, and there was no mandatory language even in place when this decision was made. That happened the next year. The appeal at 22314, which is the appeal to circuit court, is May language, is not shell language. So the question is whether or not the landowner waives their ability, whether it's preempted, because of a decision made by an inferior tribunal that didn't ever make it to circuit court. I see my time is up.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, for hearing us this morning.
The court will be in recess until 10 minutes till 11.
Thank you.